From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Russian attacks on Ukraine's energy supply as winter advances and a corruption scandal strikes the government. And later, President Trump versus the BBC in court. Also, how the end of the U.S. government shutdown seems to shake up local politics in Maine. And we catch up backstage with David Byrne on tour with his show, Who is the Sky?
Quite a number of the songs I write have what's been described as like an anthropologist from Mars quality. It can be a little bit profound and a little bit funny at the same time.
And first we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, November 15, 2025.
For KAXC News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Connecting with nature is part of the Anishinaabe way of life, and on the Red Lake Nation, a charter school is seeking to help foster that connection, incorporating Ojibwe language and tradition with the seasons. Red Lake's only charter school recently partnered with the Nature Conservancy for the purchase of a new pontoon to take environmental learning out of the classroom. The nonprofit's tribal relations coordinator, John Littlewolf, is at the Boy Fort Band with ties to the Cass Lake area. He says the goals of the Nature Conservancy align well with the priorities of the Red Lake Nation.
Peatlands, water quality, science and monitoring, these are our specialties at the Nature Conservancy. And so again, it is a natural fit with the Red Lake Nation on so many fronts. And this opportunity is such an exciting one for me because these students are going to be able to experience something that I wish I would have had this opportunity going to school to be able to get the classroom out onto the water.
During the inaugural pontoon outing on Fuller's Lake Wednesday, a handful of charter school families braved the cool November weather for boat rides and hot chocolate. Fuller's Lake is tiny compared to the nearby Lower Red Lake, but features interesting islands and beneath the water's surface, some underwater caves. The charter school's executive director, Nate Taylor, says he was reminiscing about special memories.
So we grew up playing all through this area. Like I said, I was drowned in this lake. We were kids, we swam all the time here. And it just was, it's like one of those epiphany moments, like we were just in the moment and you're really happy. And I started singing a song because I was remembering him.
Taylor says the song he was gently singing above the roar of the pontoon motor was one he wrote for his younger brother, who died young from juvenile diabetes. Fuller's Lake is just a couple miles away from the charter school and will be one of the many water bodies within the Red Lake Nation the students will explore with their new equipment.
We wanted to know about, you know, almost every single tree that's out there, every single plant that's out there, every single, because we did know at one point, every fish that's out there. So this boat will give us the opportunity to get kids out on the water and, you know, get in to learn about, you know, Mother Nature from a perspective that you don't really get to if you don't have a boat.
Ndaji Nitawaging is the name of the Ojibwe Language Intensive Charter School for grades K through 8. Kindergartners and first graders experience more Ojibwe immersion than older students, but the entire school's curriculum is closely tied with language and seasonal traditions.
There's types of seasons when we gather wild rice, type season we gather blueberries, strawberries, maple syrup, and just reconnecting. I think it's our moral responsibility to do that and to get our kids to do that, because our people always thought seven generations down the line. Our ancestors thought of us, and that's why I feel like Red Lake is so strong.
Taylor says the school, initially chartered 4 years ago, stemmed from a decade of dreams that began with a pre-K program called the Wasabik Ojibwe Immersion School.
This school kind of evolved from that because we were teaching kids the language at 3 and 4 years old, but you need to keep on them because at that school it was only 4 hours for 4 days.
Revitalizing language and education is key, Taylor says. The U.S. and Canada's prior policies of residential boarding school systems frequently took Indigenous students out of their communities where they were punished for speaking Indigenous languages or for practicing traditional customs, in addition to suffering other abuses.
My wife and I had some firsthand experience. We went to Haskell Indian Nations, and it's a college that's built on an old boarding school. So you can see like the evidence of what happened. Mm-hmm. You've seen child handcuffs and different things, a historical center there of, you know, of what happened. There was railroad tracks, and they would ship us in like cattle, and a little bit of the history of what happened to our people and why we don't speak our language.
Native American students continued to face several challenges within the traditional American education system after the boarding school era. And Aji Nitawaging's Director of Academics, Rochelle Johnson, says the school takes a more holistic approach to education.
We develop a strong sense of belonging, a strong sense of who they are as young Native people in the community, and we're really community-based. Practice local culture with, and teach that.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXC News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. This week, Ukraine is facing what could be the most harmful corruption probe in the 5 years that Volodymyr Zelensky has been president. Ukraine's independent anti-corruption agencies say that associates close to Zelensky plotted to skim some $100 million from the country's energy sector. This comes as Ukraine experiences power blackouts because of Russian strikes on the energy system. NPR's Joanna Kakissis joins us now from Kyiv. Joanna, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Scott.
And please tell us what's going on in this investigation.
So, Scott, this investigation was conducted by two agencies that monitor the Ukrainian state for graft. They're the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine and the Special Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office. And this probe is extensive. It took 15 months, used about 1,000 hours of wiretaps. There were seven alleged participants, including Timur Mindich. He's a close business associate of Zelensky's. Investigators say this group manipulated contracts at Enerhoatom, which is Ukraine's state nuclear energy company, and they got kickbacks, laundering roughly $100 million, like you mentioned earlier. The scandal has forced the resignation of two ministers in Zelensky's government so far, but Zelensky has not been implicated in this probe, and he is calling for the prosecution of those accused of committing crimes.
And Joanna, what do you hear from Ukrainians?
Well, Scott, we've spoken to several Ukrainians in Kyiv about this corruption probe, and they are enraged, for lack of a better word. Alexandra Pukidko, she's 28 and works in marketing, and she told us this scandal is especially galling as Ukraine struggles to protect its power plants from constant Russian attacks.
It hits very hard when Ukrainians are sitting here without electricity and that our energy workers are working hard to restore it. When corruption happens on such a large scale, I have a very negative reaction. And it's also very painful because I love Ukraine very much.
She told us that Ukraine must be united as it continues to defend itself from Russia, and that it's painful to consider not trusting Zelensky right now.
Has corruption been an issue in Ukraine?
Yeah, corruption used to be a big problem here, especially on the government level. But in the last decade, Ukraine has made great strides in improving transparency and accountability and appointing these independent agencies that investigate corruption. The European Union is considering Ukraine's membership right now, partly because of all this progress in fighting corruption. So Ukrainians want to make sure there is no backsliding. We spoke with Mikhail Tkach. He's an investigative journalist at Ukrainska Pravda, a prominent news outlet here. He reports on corruption, and he points out that there were mass protests this summer when Parliament and Zelensky tried to take away the independence of Ukraine's anti-corruption agencies and bring them under a prosecutor general appointed by Zelensky.
Якби вдалося знищити незалежність НАБУ і САП,
Tkach is saying if they had managed to destroy this independence, then the current investigation might not have happened, because how independent can a prosecutor general appointed by the president's office be? Now, Scott, Ukrainians also associate corruption with Russia. Activists have told me that Russia used to use corrupted Ukrainian politicians in the past to control Ukraine. And Scott, I should also say that Ukrainians say corruption during wartime is something like murder, that soldiers die if resources that could go to the front line are stolen.
And of course, the war rages on. What's the latest from the front lines?
Well, Ukrainian troops are in a very difficult battle right now to defend Pokrovsk, a city in eastern Ukraine. Russian troops have been trying to occupy the city for nearly 2 years and have now infiltrated it. We spoke by phone to soldiers in four brigades defending Pokrovsk, including Volodymyr Polovyi of the 7th Rapid Response Corps.
The brigades are really exhausted. The enemy has changed its tactic. We have the infiltration of infantry groups, and they are covered by the swarms of drones.
Another soldier we talked to described looking up at the sky and seeing so many drones that they are literally crashing into each other. Soldiers are saying, we need more resources to hold on.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I bet you know that U.S. airports have been in turmoil lately.
We had cancellations well above 4%. It was a mess. On Saturday, 81 staffing triggers in the national airspace. And again, if you traveled those days, you know how bad it was with the cancellations.
That's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy on Fox News this week. Even though the government shutdown is over and air traffic controllers are getting paid again, it could still be several days until air travel's back to normal, which poses the question, in an era of government shutdowns and threats of shutdowns, is there a better way to keep air controllers on the job? Robert Poole believes the government should get out of the business of air traffic control like Canada did nearly 30 years ago. Mr. Poole is director of transportation policy at the Reason Foundation, a libertarian think tank, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here, Scott.
How would making air traffic controllers private employees improve things?
It turns out that it's not just Canada. There are 94 countries where a shutdown of air traffic system because of government budget could not happen. These other air traffic service providers are not part of the government budget. They've been essentially depoliticized. Most of them are still government corporations, but they get all of their funding directly from aviation user fees. And all around the world, airlines, business jets pay those fees practically every place except in U.S. airspace. We have the system funded by the ticket tax that you and I and everyone pays when we fly. That's the principal source of funding for the FAA. You would sever the connection between the tax system and the organization and funding of the air traffic system. And that's the method that I think would be the best solution to the problems that we've had during this unprecedented length of government shutdown.
But don't labor actions happen under the ordinary circumstances of life?
They do happen, particularly in France. Fortunately, we don't have that. Since Ronald Reagan was president and fired a bunch of controllers for being on strike, it's against the law for controllers in the United States to strike.
Do you have any concerns about safety that a private entity in the air traffic control business could look for ways to cut corners?
That's certainly a thing to take into account. FAA has two functions. Number one, it's the safety regulator for all of aviation. Number two, it's the operator of the air traffic control system. Now, that is a conflict of interest, basically, because everything else in aviation, FAA regulates at arm's length. But it's regulating its own workforce when it regulates the air traffic system. I co-authored an article with a former FAA administrator about 15 years ago, pointing out several examples where you could contrast a fault in airline pilots who overflew at night, but falling asleep apparently, versus controllers being asleep at the switch. The FAA came down much harder on the airline pilots, and there were several examples cited in our article. Separating the air traffic system from FAA and setting it up as a separate entity. And I don't think necessarily should be private. It can be a government corporation like most of the ones in the 95 countries that I mentioned.
Would it be simpler just to pass a law that would require air traffic controllers to be paid during shutdowns?
That would certainly help, but it wouldn't prevent the disruption that comes from having the government shut down. You still are going to have controllers taking time off in a stressful situation like this. That would help, definitely, but I don't think it's the whole answer.
You have been pushing this idea, and others have. A coalition from Al Gore to Donald Trump, not a phrase I get to say a lot, has been pushing this idea for some time. Why hasn't it happened?
There are two main reasons. One is Congress loves to micromanage FAA. The FAA budget is pitiful, especially when it comes to air traffic control investment. Perhaps a bigger problem is all the private plane people in the United States. So they have a huge caucus, General Aviation Caucus in Congress. Some of those Congress members are actually pilots themselves. The money comes from the business jet organization, NBAA, National Business Aviation Association. Why are they so committed? Because unlike what business jets pay anywhere else in the world, including Canada, based on gross weight times distance flown, they pay a small fuel tax, which, according to FAA, covers about 10% of the allocated cost of controlling all the business jet traffic in our airspace. So they're very powerful. They lobby a lot, and they have been the opponents every time there's been a serious effort to reform the system.
Do you think the recent turmoil has renewed your argument, revitalized it, if you please?
I think so, and I hope so. I mean, I've been doing interviews all week.
Oh, so we're not the first people to think of you. Well,
No, you're obviously the most important. So it's been an educational effort for me to really practice for what kind of questions might you ask today.
Robert Poole is Director of Transportation Policy at the Reason Foundation. Thanks so much for being with us, and clear skies ahead for you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Tell anyone you work for NPR, and the next question often is, have you ever been to a tiny desk? The concert series began 17 years ago and has showcased superstars, including Lady Gaga, kickstarted the careers of many newcomers. Later today on All Things Considered, we hear from the team behind the desk. Tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. And you're listening to NPR News.
It's 18 minutes after 8 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for listening to People Powered, KAXE, and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. 9 o'clock this morning, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. Stories about epic road trips. And 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. At noon, it's the history of recorded jazz with volunteer Paul Kivy. 1 o'clock, Native Lights podcast, and at 1:30, Season Watch podcast. Local businesses can help defend the future of KAXE and keep People Powered Radio on the air. Visit kaxe.org/give to learn about sponsorship options. A big thank you to all of our current business supporters. The Laurentian Chamber of Commerce hosts a community bonfire at Silver Lake in Virginia this Wednesday, 5 to 7. Enjoy holiday music and make your own s'mores, and soup and chili will be served.
This is People Powered KAXE, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota, and sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXE.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump says he will sue the BBC for up to $5 billion. Even after the British broadcaster formally apologized for a misleading edit of the speech that he gave on January 6th. The dispute has already prompted the resignation of two top executives at the BBC, including its head of news. Journalist Willem Marks in London has been following the story and joins us now. Willem, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
What exactly did the BBC admit to?
Well, they acknowledged that during a documentary broadcast as part of its flagship Panorama series, that January 6th speech by President Trump was edited in a way that it spliced together remarks made nearly an hour apart. That created the impression he made a continuous call to fight like hell and march to the Capitol. In a statement, the BBC said it accepted that the edit, quote, unintentionally created the impression that we were showing a single continuous section of the speech. And they acknowledged this gave the mistaken impression that President Trump had made a direct call for violent action. The documentary was broadcast a short time ahead of the US 2024 presidential election, and the chairman of the board of the BBC governance, Samir Shah, said it would not be broadcast again.
And what was President Trump's response?
Well, in short, he said the apology from the BBC wasn't enough. A week ago, his team had issued an initial threat that demanded a retraction, an apology, and a financial settlement. In that first letter, his attorney suggested he was willing to file a billion-dollar lawsuit. But last night, Trump told reporters on Air Force One en route to Florida he and his attorneys would now sue the BBC for anywhere between $1 billion and $5 billion sometime next week. The broadcaster had, he said, admitted that they cheated and, quote, changed the words coming out of my mouth. Trump also said the UK government, in the form of Prime Minister Keir Starmer, was embarrassed by what had happened, and he planned to call Starmer over the weekend.
Now, the BBC says it doesn't believe there's a legal basis for defamation. Why?
Well, the BBC says that while it sincerely regrets the manner of the edit and it's refused so far to offer a financial settlement, legal experts I've been speaking to say that's likely because the documentary in question didn't air extensively in the United States. So if Trump were to file suit in Florida as expected, he'd have to prove Americans watched it and it harmed or damaged his reputation in some way. While here in the UK, though, legal statutes of limitations for defamation, they've already passed.
What are the consequences for the BBC so far?
Well, the head of news and the director general, the BBC's top executive, they've both stepped down over the past week. The government's felt forced to back the BBC in Parliament with the UK's culture minister, a woman called Lisa Nandy, defending the broadcaster at a time of political polarisation and widespread misinformation.
It is by far the most widely used and trusted source of news in the United Kingdom. At a time when the lines are being dangerously blurred between fact and opinion, news and polemic, the BBC stands apart.
And listeners and viewers have been expressing their anger at the idea that their money, which funds the BBC through what's known as a licence fee, could be used to pay a settlement or indeed legal damages to a foreign leader. I spoke to Stuart Purvis, who previously ran ITN. It's the major commercial news broadcaster in Britain, and it's thus the BBC's main rival on TV. And he told me this criticism of the BBC was unprecedented.
The BBC has faced many complaints over the years, which have gone to court. Sometimes it's settled, sometimes it hasn't and is lost. But there's absolutely nothing compared with the scale, either in monetary terms, by President Trump, or indeed the publicity is getting.
Now, there are other pressures the BBC is facing for sure, Scott, in particular around its coverage of the war in Gaza, but this is by far the biggest challenge it faces right now.
Journalist Willem Marks in London, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This week's vote to end the federal government shutdown sharply divided Congress along party lines, and it exposed rifts within the Democratic Party. That divide was clearly evident in Maine's congressional delegation and the public's reaction to how they voted. Kevin Miller with Maine Public Radio reports.
It's a cold, blustery afternoon as two dozen people line a busy road in Waterville, Maine, to protest the deal ending the government shutdown. Most of their ire is directed at a single man.
Well, Angus really hurt us in Maine.
Angus is Senator Angus King. And like a lot of folks in Maine, Donna Doucette calls him by his first name.
I've supported him from the beginning, and I think he sold us out. Especially when I'm retired, still dealing with cancer. I don't need that now, nor does my husband, who's older than me.
King is an independent, but he caucuses with Democrats. As part of the deal that he and seven Democrats negotiated, Senate Republicans promised a future vote on extending subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. But critics say they betrayed the Democratic cause by failing to secure an actual extension of the tax credits that 20 million ACA users rely upon. Some protesters called King a coward. Cindy Burke says he caved.
We held off for 40 days, I think, and I just feel that we got nothing from it. And a promise to have a vote on the ACA, I don't believe that is going to happen. I don't trust the Republicans.
Maine's four-person congressional delegation is one of the smallest in the country. Yet their mixed votes on the bill to reopen the government reflect the national divide over the fraught issue. Maine's Republican Senator Susan Collins blamed the shutdown on Democrats and their leader, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Yet she helped broker the compromise as chairwoman of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee. Maine Representative Jared Golden blasted his party's strategy and cast one of the six Democratic House votes to reopen the government. But his fellow Maine Democrat, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, views the compromise as a, quote, capitulation.
Many of us felt like there's a lot of momentum behind us, and the Republicans are feeling these concerns. They're losing court battles. They're getting the same calls we are. And we should move them to a decision, not the promise of a vote.
Angus King says he was surprised by the ferocity of the backlash. He defends his decision, saying Republicans made clear they would not negotiate on the ACA until the government reopened. Although he supports extending the subsidies, he says the shutdown harmed Americans and empowered Trump.
And I get it. People want some place to stand up, and they felt this was it. But it's backfiring in the sense of hurting a lot of people without getting what we want.
It's unclear how shutdown partisanship will impact next year's elections in Maine, a state where 30% of voters are independents. And Maine could play an outsized role in control of Congress after 2026. Golden isn't seeking re-election in a House district that Trump won twice, giving Republicans an opportunity to flip the seat. And the shutdown is already popping up in the heated Democratic primary to challenge Collins, one of the Senate's most vulnerable Republicans.
I want to reiterate my call for Leader Schumer to step down.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's Democrat Graham Platner, a Marine Corps veteran and oysterman whose anti-establishment message has drawn huge crowds despite recent controversy over past comments and a tattoo widely recognized as a Nazi symbol. He's since covered it. Platner denounced the shutdown deal, blaming Schumer, who opposed the deal but couldn't keep his party unified against it. Platner also took a not-so-subtle jab at Democratic Governor Janet Mills, who was recruited by Schumer to run for the Senate.
The governor has Chuck Schumer's phone number. She should give him a call and have a chat about that.
Yes.
Mills told reporters this week that she strongly disagrees with the deal to end the shutdown. Back in Waterville, protest organizer Karen Heck says she's frustrated.
And I just think that most people are tired of a government that doesn't work for them. Whether that's a schism in the Democratic Party or not, I think that the old system is not working for us, and a lot of people are angry about that.
And Heck adds that she thinks people will demand change, possibly starting in next year's primaries. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Miller.
A new book asks, among many provocative questions, is the elevation of human above all other species, indeed above the Earth itself, responsible for many of Earth's problems? Amitav Ghosh, the Indian Bengali writer whom Foreign Policy magazine has named one of today's most important global thinkers, has collected some of his most striking essays from over the past 25 years. His collection is called Wild Fictions, Essays on Literature, Empire, and the Environment. And Amitav Ghosh joins us from the studios of member station WVTF in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You believe that what we call the climate crisis, at its heart, is a political crisis.
Yes, it's certainly political, but it's also, I would say, cultural and imaginative. I mean, it's very hard for us today, after, you know, several centuries of modernity, to recognize that the world is, in a sense, animate, that it's actually an actor, and this actor is now sort of lashing out against us.
Lashing out against us?
Yes, absolutely, yes. Reacting to, you know, our greenhouse gas emissions that human beings have put in the atmosphere. Absolutely.
Hmm. You have a different view of what many in the West call a migration crisis.
Yes.
Help us understand your point of view.
Well, my point of view, I have to say, is largely sort of based upon the European Mediterranean experience. I did do a lot of research in Italy, especially during the height of the so-called European migration crisis. And that was when I realized that, you know, what is actually driving these journeys is not just political or economic. There is also a very important factor is really modern technology, especially modern communications technologies. Every bit of these journeys, you know, they occur through the cell phone. So it was a really sobering realization that, you know, this modern communications technology is really one of the drivers, in my opinion, of this enormous movement of people that we are now seeing across the planet.
As you note, you're Bengali, and you see the migration kind of fitting a historical tradition of young Bengalis going far across the world.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's a little known fact that during the age of sail, a very large percentage of the world's seamen were actually from Bengal. So what happens with these migrations is that they set up networks. You know, people write back to their villages. That creates, as it were, a sort of model of aspiration, you know. So for the young kid in the village, he thinks, okay, my cousin or my grandfather made this journey, so maybe I should set off on this journey as well. Just as happened with Europeans in the United States, you know. I mean, these networks become really an engine for moving people. And essentially, I think this has become also, these pre-existing networks are a very important element of the migrations that we are now seeing.
We cited the afterword in introducing you because it's a thought that really shook me up when you say it is the elevation of human above all other species, indeed above the Earth itself, that is responsible for our current planetary crisis. How so?
Yes, you know, our culture has become more and more anthropocentric, that is centered upon human beings, to the point where we really don't even recognize that other forms of sentience might exist. But recent work in botany, for example, shows us that trees communicate with each other, that they have languages, that they work as communities, that a forest is much more than just a collection of trees, that it's a living entity which makes history, which adapts to changes of various kinds. And I think we are beginning to see increasingly more and more kinds of sentience, you know, in the world around us, more and more kinds of consciousness.
This is a question I can't even believe I'm even posing, but should we put our human species and our survival, our welfare, above that of, well, fill in the blanks, animals, plants?
Well, what we know about life now is that it's a very complex web. So that everything is dependent on everything else. For example, if we do end up exterminating all the bees, all our systems will collapse. All our food systems will collapse. We know that now. So it's not really a question of, even out of just the purest self-interest, we find ourselves in a position of care where we must care for these other entities all around us because our own lives absolutely fundamentally depend on them.
Amitav Ghosh is new collection of essays, Wild Fictions. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. There is no one way to grieve, according to scientists who study loss. For some, the answer is talking about what they're going through with others who are grieving. Nancy Eve Cohen recently met with a bereavement group where members don't just talk, they walk.
Nearly two dozen people, some carrying walking sticks, gather near a park bench in Northampton, Massachusetts. Bereavement counselor Shelley Beth Len reminds them this is a judgment-free zone.
Give everybody a safe space to feel grief, whatever that looks like and sounds like.
Len is with Cooley Dickinson Hospital.
It's not an exercise group, even though we're outside moving our bodies. Slow down for the people behind. Sound good?
Yeah. People break into twos and threes walking beneath the trees. Conversations range from what to do with a late husband's books to holding onto his clothes.
Yeah, this summer I was wearing Lou's gardening hat.
Yep.
Which I realize looks really silly on me, but I didn't care.
Helena Donovan's husband died 2.5 years ago. She says walking lifts her mood.
The movement is really good for me because after my husband died, I was doing way too much sitting around. And this gets me up and gets me moving, and I always feel better when I move.
As they walk, conversations deepen and flow. Up ahead, three women and a dog keep pace. Elaine Beaudoin says walking side by side rather than sitting eye to eye helps people talk. Today, she's grappling with what's next.
The first year, you're in the throes of it all. But the second year is, well, this is my life now. What am I going to do with it?
Do I move forward? Do I just sit here?
The quietness is getting pretty loud in the house.
There's the loud quiet and the empty space.
I wake up in the morning and, you know, I reach over and she's not there.
That's Roger Brown remembering his wife, Jean. Many walk together every week, some for years. The passing of time is a big topic. For Jill Mendez, it's been nearly 4 years without her partner, Patrick.
The grief is now more of a yearning.
It never goes away.
Yeah, it's always with you. It becomes part of your anatomy almost.
Mendez is speaking with Maureen Cahillane, who's 90. She's walking with a cane. Her husband, James, died about 2 years ago.
Those times when you're alone, not always alone, it's kind of empty. This group is quite a bit of a help. I don't know why, but just to know that other people are dealing with the same sadness.
They wend their way around the park. Joel Walker, whose wife Deborah died in January, notes it's nice when the group walks on a warm day.
And the breeze is blowing through and it's feeling good. But if we get into winter, I don't know how that will be.
The group will get into winter. They walk in this Massachusetts park year round. Seeing the seasons change is healing for some.
Being outside, it distracts your mind. Sometimes we are so focused on our pain. But when you are outside, you're walking, it kind of helps.
That's Diana, who asked that we only use her middle name because many in her community don't know she's grieving. She says walking one-on-one, the conversations can go deep. Her husband, Philip, used to be the person she walked with. He died last December.
It's a therapy, but it's also hard because I can no longer walk with him.
So now she walks with others who are grieving. Moving and talking makes it easier to open up and feel understood. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Eve Cohen in Western Massachusetts.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:39. You're listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Stay Human. This week's story is about epic trips with friends and families. Great music, too. Hit the road with us this morning at 9 or tomorrow evening at 5. And at 10 o'clock this morning, Jerry Bredeman is your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support for KAXE comes from the Third Coast Chamber Collective, presenting chamber music up north, featuring an internationally renowned accordion and violin ensemble from Poland at Co-House, November 20th, 7 p.m. Tickets available at thirdcoastchambercollective.com. Mountain Iron Buell Drama and Chair present Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, November 20th through the 23rd at Marriott Auditorium. Find tickets and showtimes at chair-mn.org. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXE.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. An unusually strong atmospheric river storm has city officials in Los Angeles on edge. The National Weather Service is warning of the potential for rock slides and debris flows in areas ravaged by wildfires earlier this year. The rain is expected to last through the weekend. Attorney General Pam Bondi has named a senior federal prosecutor to look into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's ties to prominent Democrats. President Trump had publicly called for the investigation. And the Federal Aviation Administration has begun taking steps to restore flights at the nation's airports, citing improvements in staffing levels at air traffic facilities. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And at last, it's time for sports. MVPs repeat in baseball and a tale of two conferences in the NFL. Sports writer Howard Bryant joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, my friend. National League MVP, unsurprisingly, Shohei Ohtani of the Los Angeles Dodgers, who pitches, he hits. I've been told he even prepares the clubhouse luncheons. In any event, his third consecutive MVP, unsurprising but still amazing.
Incredible. And no, not surprising, because he's the most unique player in the game. And, you know, can I just take a second, Scott, to say that I am still on a high. The high is still high from the baseball season and from the World Series in particular. And it was just so great that I was talking to a friend of mine last night who said, you know what? Baseball is coming very soon, but I wouldn't be disappointed if there was a game tomorrow. And so for Ohtani to win the MVP, he's got four of them now. And it's just, you start to wonder, what does anybody else in the game have to do to win the MVP in the National League? Nobody else can pitch and hit like him. Nobody else is pitching and hitting. He is, you know, if he has an average season, he's still doing more because he's so unique than everybody else in the game. And so, once again, well-deserved for, you know, unanimous MVPs. He's in Barry Bonds territory. He's moving into a space that only the very highest altitude of players can achieve. Yeah.
American League, Aaron Judge of the Yankees, a great player, was the MVP. But did the sports writers who vote miss a chance to celebrate Cal Raleigh of the Seattle Mariners, who actually hit more home runs, 60, and helped propel Seattle just a game short of the World Series?
No, I don't think they did. And there's a couple of reasons for it. One, I don't like the fact that we try to turn this into science. The MVP does not have specific, it's not a statistical award only. And And that helps Cal Raleigh, and that also hurt Cal Raleigh, as the same as it did for Aaron Judge. And also, just so you know, yes, it was the sports writers who do the voting, but the voting ends at the end of the regular season. We have to have our ballots in before the last game of the season. So therefore, the postseason doesn't count. So nobody knew what the Mariners were going to do. So I know people like to make that argument, but it just doesn't hold. Both guys were deserving. Both guys were, you know, could have won. But Aaron Judge had a ridiculous, he hit 100 points higher than Raleigh did. And Raleigh's a catcher, obviously plays the most difficult position on the field to hit 60 home runs, to be a switch hitter. But to me, maybe I'm just getting soft in my old age, Scott, but I really don't see the debate here. One guy won, one guy didn't win, but they were both absolutely tremendous. And once again, there is so much happening in the game right now. The only thing that I fear is that they're going to take this goodwill, take this great feeling, and have baseball do what it has always done, which is try to ruin it by labor disputes. Let's please not do that. Yeah.
Briefly on the football, halfway through the NFL regular season in the AFC, nobody would have predicted that the New England Patriots would be the best team so far. Well, maybe you did, Howard, but in any event.
A little Boston talk for you.
And however, in the NFC, the front-running teams are the front-running teams. How do you think things are going to play out?
I think it's going to happen with defense in the NFC, obviously. You know, you've got Philly, the defending champions, but of course nobody's ever happy in Philly, but they're still a great team. You know, they play the Lions, they play Detroit. That's going to be a great game. You've got, the Rams are very, very good defensively. The NFC is very, very tough, and I think that the good teams are going to stay pretty good at the top of it. I'm happy that Seattle's good. In the AFC, yeah, Patriots, Broncos, Colts, a lot of fun right there. And obviously, let's not forget your dynasty. The Chiefs are still there. They're 5-4. They're not far away. But we got some new faces in the AFC. Fun to look at.
Howard Bryant, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
No, my pleasure, Scott.
How are you, David? Great to see you.
David Byrne was worried that he'd kept us up too late.
Do you normally do interviews this late?
Every now and then. When we're in, like, the White House Situation Room or something like that. Sometimes we do that. David Byrne's just wrapped up another night in his busy Who is the Sky tour. It's a stage presentation of music and performance art, where musicians and dancers seem to step and soar within scenes and landscapes of forests and city streets, of people, skyscrapers, mountains, and protests. The show also has interludes, where David Byrne, who's been an influential artist since he was frontman for Talking Heads, starting in the mid-1970s, shares stories about his life and about the world. He met us backstage at Chicago's Auditorium Theater.
What a wonderful show.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad you came.
There's so much joy in this show. Do you feel we need it now?
I certainly do. Other people who have seen it, they've said the same thing. They said, we need this.
Everybody laughs and everybody cries. Everybody lives and everybody dies. Everybody eats and everybody loves. Everybody knows what everybody does. Everybody's going through the changes, every complication.
Is it fun to be back in front of people?
It's been a few years, but yeah, I've gotten more comfortable with it. And
excuse me, you've gotten more comfortable with it?
More comfortable than when I first started.
Oh.
Then it was more a compulsion.
I see.
It was a way of asserting my identity or whatever. And now it's more considered. I get more enjoyment. Just pure enjoyment out of it. And I realize I can play with the form of what a music concert can be. That's a lot of fun.
Everybody wonders what you're gonna do. Everything is closer, everything is true. Everybody's starting everything again. Everybody's outside now, they're coming in. Everybody.
Tell us about the stagecraft in the show. It's amazing. There's scenes of New York, there's scenes of a forest, there's scenes of the seashore.
I welcome you to my house.
Scenes of your apartment.
You see it. You see it in the show.
House and a garden. There are plants and trees. Take a closer inspection.
I thought, should I let people see my apartment? Why not?
Now everybody's coming to my house. And I'm never going to be alone. Yeah, everybody's coming to my house. I'm never gonna go back home.
I was inspired by a German dance choreographer, a woman named Pina Bausch. I saw one of her pieces. There was just one scene where there was a projection of like a jungle or something like that. And it wasn't that complete, but it kind of, I thought, you could do this where it looks like the performers are in that environment. Mm-hmm. I said, let's see if we can use the screens to put us in different environments that somehow resonate with the different songs or with the world that we live in. So I thought, oh, we can put ourselves in a forest, we can put ourselves in a street, we can put ourselves on the moon.
Well, and I was startled at that moment. You give us a vision of heaven in like the first 3 minutes of the show.
Yeah.
Everyone is trying to get to the bar. The name of the bar. The bar is called heaven.
That particular moment is the band in heaven. Very moving for me.
They play my favorite song.
Sometimes it's kind of, it kind of choke up and it's kind of a little hard to proceed.
They play it all night long. Oh, heaven, heaven is a place.
Without giving away the punchline, what you suggest is don't look into the heavens for heaven.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I kind of tell the audience, here it is, yeah.
There is a party. Everyone is there. Everyone will leave at exactly the same time.
May I ask you about autism?
Sure. I just felt like that's the way I am. That's the way I see and understand the world. And didn't feel bad. I didn't feel sad about it or anything like that. And then sort of positive things like being able to intensely focus on a project or writing a song or whatever it might be.
I wonder if it isn't in some ways hasn't been a real creative spur for you.
I think quite a number of the songs I write even now have what's been described as like an anthropologist from Mars quality of trying to understand human behavior in some way. And that kind of goes along with that as well. That's kind of useful. I mean, it can be a little bit profound and a little bit funny at the same time.
Your music has always been different. You can't say, oh, it belongs to this, it belongs to that. It's always been you.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous, and I can't relax. Can't sleep, bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est?
I'm old enough to have the first kind of pop music I heard was in the mid and late 60s and early 70s. And it seemed like there was this approval that musicians and songwriters were allowed to experiment and try all different sorts of things. Mm-hmm. That was even encouraged, even to the point where it was kind of expected. So I thought, oh, this is what this life is about. Constantly experimenting, trying different things, seeing what works, what doesn't work. You're not supposed to just repeat yourself over and over again. I assume that's the job description.
It's a very joyful show, but you do have some distressing images that are thrown up on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Recent images.
Yeah. I have an old song called Life During Wartime.
Heard of a band that is loaded with weapons, packed up and ready to go. Heard of some grave sites out by the highway, place where nobody knows.
Depicts a kind of a world that's descended into kind of urban kind of guerrilla warfare, in a sense. And it's written kind of from the point of view of the protagonist or whatever. And Some of it seems to be very resonant and kind of relevant to things that are happening today. I thought at the very end of the song, I throw up a lot of images of ICE raids and people being beaten.
I got three passports, I got a couple of visas. Don't even know my real name. Out on a hillside, the trucks are loading. Everything's ready to roll.
Why was it important
to you to do that?
I don't want to kind of completely depress people, but I want to say, oh no, we're entertaining you, but there are things going on in the world, and we're aware of that, and we're not going to pretend that that's not happening.
Are you saying something, or are you asking people to reflect and reach their own conclusion?
If I can possibly do it, I don't want to tell people, do this, be like this. The whole theatrical thing is show, don't tell. Let them see what's possible rather than telling them what's possible.
What goes through your mind these days when you sing Same As It Ever Was, the phrase over and over?
Once in a lifetime, same as it ever was.
Yeah.
This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful life.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack.
To me, it's a song about trying to understand the world you live in. Very mundane stuff. Your wife, your house, your car, whatever. Do I know this stuff? Do I belong here? Do I understand it? And then the chorus is about the water and letting days go by. The choruses to me are more about this kind of joyful surrender.
Mm-hmm.
The contrast with the questioning and the puzzling in the verses.
How do I work this? You may ask yourself, well, where is that large automobile?
There's kind of asking questions, and then the answer seems to be a kind of transcendence and surrender.
I found it, to hear it tonight, very comforting. It's the ripple, not the wave, that's happening.
Yeah.
It's the small strokes.
Same as it ever was. Same as it ever was. Same as it ever was.
And if you can describe those things, the big stuff kind of takes care of itself in a way.
Same as it ever was.
The world in a grain of sand or whatever, you can kind of describe a small situation and everyone recognizes that.
Water dissolving and water removing. There is water at the bottom of the ocean. Remove the water.
David Byrne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. At 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman is your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. And at noon, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. Support comes from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses. Working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org. Our weather for today, clearing skies with temperatures in the low 40s, breezy northwest winds 10 to 30 miles per hour, lows tonight near 23, and for tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid-30s to low 40s, and northwest wind up to 20 miles per hour. Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night this Thursday. Doors will open at 6, performances start at 7. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.